Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on the 28th of January 2017. My name's Hereward Fenton and it's great to be with you today. Today I'm going to be talking about torture. It's a subject that I feel quite strongly about and one which I've done a considerable amount of research on. And I want to really give you the benefit of my understanding of what torture really is all about and why it's something that we really can't compromise on. And the problem with it, the problem with getting this out so that most people understand, is that there are misinterpretations that people have about what torture is actually used for in a practical sense, whether in sort of ordinary like policing work or in situations of warfare. And this has been further obscured by endless Hollywood representations of, you know, tough guy cops, you know, roughing people up to get information out of them. And the many programs that have been on TV, particularly since September 11, 2001, which have sort of romanticized and glorified aspects of torture, because the torture has been done in the name of a good cause. You know, the classic scenario under which torture is validated is the ticking time bomb scenario, and there's been movies about it. There's been quite a few different B-grade Hollywood treatments of this, and the idea is always that there's some kind of ticking time bomb, and, you know, millions of people could be killed, and you've got some suspect who you know knows information, who doesn't want to tell you information about how you might be able to defuse that bomb. And of course, in that highly hypothetical scenario, which by the way has never occurred, you can craft a justification for torture. But even then, even in that highly artificial hypothetical situation, which has never existed in reality, there are still massive problems with it. Because what you have to understand about it, with torture, right, is that the only reason you'd be torturing someone in the first place, unless you're a psychopath, unless you're doing it because you enjoy it, and that's something I want to get into, because that does have a lot to do with torture and why torture is really done, right? But let's just rule out for a moment the psychopathic motivation, the sadistic psychopathic motivation, and say, look, you know, you're only going to torture because you think it might have a practical result. Okay. In that case, the only reason you will be torturing a person to get information is because there's something you don't know, right? And you think they know, but you don't necessarily know that they know. And you've got no way of knowing when they tell you something, whether that something they tell you is the truth or not the truth. You see, if you already knew the facts, you wouldn't need to torture someone to get the facts. So torturing someone is done in a state of ignorance. You're ignorant about something. And so part of that state of ignorance is that you don't even really know whether the person you're torturing knows what you're trying to find out. So in the case of the ticking time bomb, the individual may or may not know the location of the time bomb. The information that the individual gives you may or may not be correct, even if they do know. And that's the best case scenario, right? But it gets much worse from there, because the individual may not know the information, but in order to stop the torture, may give you information which is false. And this actually is by far the most common outcome of torture. And there are so many examples of it. It's just mind-boggling that people don't get it, you know, that this actually is the creation of false intelligence, which leads away from truth, leads away from facts. But it does, and this is another motive for why people might engage in torture, which is perhaps different to the purely sadistic, psychopathic motive, is that agencies, crime agencies, governments, security agencies, who are trying to get information, are sometimes working to an agenda where the outcome is already predetermined. And these are situations where it's never a case of a ticking time bomb. It's a case of validating a policy, justifying a policy. And the classic example I can give you is the invasion of Iraq in 2003, when one key nuclear scientist had been tortured. And he gave information to the CIA, which they used as part of the case for the invasion of Iraq. Now, I don't have the exact details on this, but I have studied it in the past. And what I know is that individual lied. And that individual lied most likely to stop the waterboarding. But this is a case where those at the top of the US government had decided they wanted to invade Iraq. They just needed a reason. They needed a pretext. And, of course, the weapons of mass destruction was the best thing they came up with, and they needed intelligence to justify that conclusion. And so that's how the waterboarding came to be used to get this false narrative of weapons of mass destruction. So I think we need to actually examine torture from several different perspectives, and I want to, in this show, go into that in more detail in terms of each of those areas. But let me just cycle back now and tell you why I'm actually discussing this. Of course, it's in relation to Donald Trump's statement earlier in the week where he said he feels that torture works and that, you know, he approves of it. And this to me was a big red flag, and it's something that really bothered me. And in the last couple of days, more information has come out, and we've got another video here where he's actually stated that his own military chief, General Mattis, has vetoed torture. So I'm going to actually play to you a couple of these clips just to sort of bring you up to speed on the whole situation. And then I'll be discussing this in more detail after we come back from the break. So here is the first clip where President Trump is talking about his glowing endorsement of torture.
I have spoken as recently as 24 hours ago with people at the highest level of intelligence, and I asked them the question, does it work? Does torture work? And the answer was yes, absolutely. I want to do everything within the bounds of what you're allowed to do legally. But do I feel it works? Absolutely, I feel it works.
Now, the president added that he will rely upon the counsel of CIA Director Mike Pompeo and Secretary of Defense General James Mattis. Mattis has said torture does not work. Joining me now is Republican Senator Dr. Rand Paul of Kentucky. Senator Paul, thanks for being here. What's your reaction to what the president had to say about torture?
You know, I was comforted about a month ago when I heard that he'd had a conversation with General Mattis, who unequivocally has said that torture doesn't work. But we've also studied this. The CIA detained 119 people, 39 of them were tortured, and the conclusion of the Senate committee's report was that it didn't work. But there was also something very alarming. Of the 119 people that the CIA detained around the world, 26 of them were mistakenly identified, sometimes with people who had similar names, but they detained the wrong people. I think most Americans would be alarmed if 22% of the people we picked up and tortured were the wrong people. So, yeah, I think there's a real problem, one, whether it works or not, but two, if we get the wrong people, there's no due process, there's no sort of time to say, well, let's have a trial to find out who we have here. So, yeah, I'm alarmed by anybody that wants to go back to torture. The people in the Senate who have been tortured, namely John McCain, don't think torture is a good idea also. It's currently against the law, and I hope it will remain against the law.
Okay, so that was the summary from a few days ago. And, of course, what Rand Paul there says is quite correct. And I certainly agree with it 100%. But now, Trump has actually refined his position on this. And I'll just play the more recent clip here. And this is actually from his meeting with Theresa May, where he actually states that his opinion on torture has been overruled by, you know, his own experts, who's he's appointed and given the responsibility, and he's willing to go with their decision. Here we go.
We have a great general who has just been appointed Secretary of Defense, General James Mattis, and he has stated publicly that he does not necessarily believe in torture or waterboarding, or however you want to define it. Enhanced interrogation, I guess, would be a word that a lot of people would like to use. I don't necessarily agree, but I would tell you that he will override because I'm giving him that power. He's an expert. He's highly respected. He's the general's general. Got through the Senate very, very quickly, which in this country is not easy, I will tell you. And so I'm going to rely on him. I happen to feel that it does work. I've been open about that for a long period of time. But I am going with our leaders.
Okay, so there we have it, the follow-up statement from Trump. Now, it's actually very interesting. And I want to get into some of the more actually important questions about torture. But an interesting thing to note is Trump is taking a style here of leadership, which is quite unusual in the history of American politics, and indeed in the politics of any country, really, that you know, he makes very strong statements. He expresses his opinion in a very, very direct way, but then he's actually willing to backtrack, and he's not ashamed of that either. And he'll say, "Well, look, my opinion is not the overriding opinion here." So that is actually a bit comforting to me, I must say, because earlier in the week, when I saw the statement that he made, I thought, uh-oh, you know, this looks like we're opening the door again to, you know, what we had back in the Bush era with the dark side, as Dick Cheney famously said. You know, that was what opened the door to all these black side practices after 9/11, when Dick Cheney said we're going to turn to the dark side. And by the way, there's an excellent documentary called Taxi to the Dark Side, which I might discuss a little, because it actually explains some of the deep flaws in the concept of torture. We're just going to break. You with Truth News Radio Australia. It's great to be with you today. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I was just describing there before the break this documentary, which was made in 2007, called Taxi to the Dark Side, which probes into some of the really horrific consequences of torture and the specific US policies that enabled torture in Afghanistan. And I want to actually play to you just from the trailer to that film, and we'll get into more questions about it after that, but we'll just play the trailer to the film Taxi to the Dark Side, and then we'll have some more analysis. Here we go.
This debate is occurring because of the Supreme Court's ruling that said that we must conduct ourselves under the common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. And that common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague. What does that mean?
I know whether it was an injury that was aggravated by something, or whether he was just sick coming in. I saw his picture in the New York Times article. Before that picture, I couldn't have picked his face out. You know, my memory of him was chained up with the hood on, no sleeping.
This is not a hotel. This is not a place for them to get fat and lazy and happy.
They told us when dealing with the PUCs, as they call them, the persons under U.S. custody, they don't fall under Geneva Conventions. Basically, the only thing that we weren't allowed to do is beat them up.
We have to work sort of the dark side, if you will. We're going to spend time in the shadows. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies.
Soldiers are dying. Get the information. That's all you're told. Get the information.
Sometimes I feel that I should have gone with my own morality more than what was common.
Some would say, well, hey, you should have stopped this. You should have stopped that. Why didn't you do something? That'd be a good question. My answer would be, well, you know, it was us against them. I was over there. I didn't want to appear to be going against my fellow soldiers. Which, is that wrong? You could sit here and say that was dead wrong. Go over there and say that.
People say, well, these photographs from Abu Ghraib, they weren't real torture. I look back at those people and I say, murder's torture. Murder's the ultimate torture.
One by one, the terrorists are learning the meaning of American justice.
If they think so very little of life, and clearly 9/11 exemplified that, screw them. Anything goes.
Okay, well, that was just a taste of the film. It didn't really get into a lot of the important details of the film. The documentary was actually largely based on the story of a taxi driver who was captured in Afghanistan, and he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time and was denounced by some of the local people there. But it turned out that he was not guilty, but he was tortured to death. And that was just one case. It was one example, but the film focused on the case of this one individual to really highlight the wrongness of torture in itself intrinsically, but also the badness of the US policies in general that were being practiced in Afghanistan. Now, one thing that's really important to note, and this is going to tend to be ignored and forgotten, is that many of the practices that are already in use that are not actually designated as torture are really torture in any true sense. I mean, putting someone in solitary confinement for long periods of time can actually destroy their mind. I mean, it is a very, very, very brutal technique, which doesn't involve touching a person. It doesn't involve any physical violence. But just locking someone in solitary confinement for long periods of time is, if that's not torture, well, then really nothing's torture, because that can produce some of the most horrific effects on an individual that you can imagine. I mean, some people can survive it, others can't. It depends a little on the constitution of the individual, whether they can handle solitary confinement. That's just one case, and that's not regarded as torture. That is actually allowed under the Geneva Conventions. Other things like keeping people in pressure positions for very long periods of time is not considered torture either. And yet this causes extreme distress. And it can also cause permanent physical damage. But that just goes under the line, under the wire. It's not technically regarded as torture. So we've got all these practices that are already done, and some of them are actually done even in non-military situations. I mean, solitary confinement is used in prisons all over the world. So we've already got a situation where action that is tantamount to torture is already legitimized, which makes it all the more dangerous to think about going further and actually legitimizing acts that are overtly torture. And there we get into another kind of a gray area. As we move deeper and deeper into this spectrum that ends up with the worst imaginable horrors that you can conceive, right? That ends up with something out of like a horror movie, you know, like one of those horror movies from the what's the one, Backpacker? What's the name of it? Hostel. Sorry, yeah, Hostel. And that that movie actually, Eli Roth made that movie and actually justified the contents of it by saying, well, actually, this is the type of thing that's actually being done in Afghanistan right now. And he actually said that in an interview. But yeah, so there's a spectrum. There's a spectrum, and in the kind of early part of that spectrum, as we move to the more full-on violent physical torture, are things like waterboarding. Now, the reason why waterboarding was treated as if it were not torture by some groups, and including, you know, right up to the president, was, of course, because waterboarding doesn't leave a mark on the body. So there's this concept of, like, physical violence versus non-physical violence, or violence that doesn't leave a mark. And this is really interesting, because why is that so important? I believe it's important because obviously it's the visual effect and it's the emotional effect of seeing graphic violence, especially blood, which of course produces a visceral reaction in the observer. And all human beings have an empathic quality. And when we see violence that includes things like blood or breaking of bones or, you know, cutting off of limbs, it's very hard to suppress that visceral reaction. But if you simply see an individual that's lying down with a cloth over his face and water being poured over that cloth, and there's no blood, there's no injury to the body, then it doesn't look so bad. And this to me seems part of the way in which the psychological process by which actions like this can be legitimized. And it's actually more about, I believe, it's more about making it easier for those who are doing the torture than actually making it easier on the person. Because waterboarding is really, really bad. And I'll have more to say of that when we come back from the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, talking about torture. Don't go away. Hi, welcome back. You're at Truth News Radio. And my subject today is torture. And I'm trying to get into some of the nuances of it so we understand that why it is that certain practices were legitimized in recent years under the Bush regime, whereas others were not. And, of course, we don't really know all of the things that might have been done that were done in total secret. I mean, you know, we only know what we know. We only know what leaks out. We know that waterboarding was practiced. As to whether they did a variety of other things, well, we've seen what happened in the Abu Ghraib prison, and that seemed to encompass a wide range of sadistic practices, rituals, and bizarre behavior that obviously wasn't in the field manual, and they kind of let people just run with it and, you know, do whatever they felt like, and which kind of brought out the inner demons and the true evil that lurks within people. But again, you know, that's what we know. We don't know the stuff that was done in completely hidden, isolated black sites that never got documented. But let's talk about waterboarding, because it has been studied a lot. And famously, the late Christopher Hitchens, British writer, underwent a waterboarding session as part of a Vanity Fair piece that he actually wrote and talked about a lot on the subject. And this was back in about 2007, 2008. And what Hitchens has to say about it, and there are quite a few interviews that he did on the subject, I'll play you here one that was recorded in Canada on Newsnight. And you can see the extreme nature of what waterboarding is makes it really equivalent to pretty much the worst types of torture you can imagine, even though it doesn't involve, you know, damage to the body and blood, which again, I believe is the reason those things are avoided is possibly because it's harder for the torturer to do. Not because it makes it easier on the torturee. Okay, so let's just play a little here from this interview that was done in Canada with Hitchens back in about 2008. Here we go.
Now, fancy a bit of waterboarding? No, of course you don't. The United States government has claimed time and again that the practice which has been used on people it's picked up in the so-called war on terror is not torture. If it were, it would be both unconstitutional and a breach of international law. The magazine Vanity Fair invited the journalist Christopher Hitchens to form his own judgment. The catch was that to do so, he had to undergo the treatment himself, complete with the disorientating music which apparently accompanies it. What happens next is, unsurprisingly, disturbing.
I'll just pause it there. In the video, you can actually see Christopher Hitchens being strapped down, and they play loud music in the background, and that's actually part of the technique of disorienting people. So I'll just continue with the playing of the video here. They've just said that they've given him metal objects to grab, and if he experiences unbearable stress, he should release those objects. The sound you just heard there was Christopher Hitchens dropping the metal object, and that was less than a minute. It felt like about 30 seconds anyway. I'm sure that will be explained further in the interview, so just continuing now.
And Christopher Hitchens joins us now from California. What did it feel like?
Well, the big lie about it is, we read all the time in the press that it simulates the feeling of drowning. It doesn't simulate it at all. You are, in fact, being drowned, although, albeit slowly, under controlled conditions, and that's what it feels like. Therefore, the overriding instinct of everything in you, mentally and physically, is to fight back against this drown, smother, gag reflex, and to do anything it would take to stop it.
How long did you last, and how long did it feel you had lasted?
Very good question. Just in reverse order, it felt a lot longer than it was. The first time, I think I managed about 12 seconds. The CIA say that 30 seconds is fairly creditable. I thought I should try again after that. I felt a bit British about it, if you like. I thought I should see if I could withstand it a bit longer. I think I got to about 19 to 20 the second go-round.
But it felt much longer than that.
It felt a great deal longer than that, yes. And I was quite convinced that I had shouted the code red word to make them stop, but I hadn't at all done that. All I knew how to do was to activate the dead man's handle to drop the metal bars that told them that was enough.
The critical question:
What it would be like if one wasn't able to do that? I really, really don't like to think.
The critical question here is your judgment: is this torture?
What I say in my Vanity Fair piece is I plagiarized from Abraham Lincoln about slavery, who said, if that's not wrong, then nothing is wrong. I say about this, if this doesn't count as torture, then nothing does. Up until now, the United States has always insisted that if any other power or gang or group does it to an American, that they'll seek the death penalty for that person, as they did in Japan after the Second World War. They prosecuted their own forces for doing it in Vietnam without authorization. Thus, I think the very least you can say is that to have it authorized and practiced with the official permission is crossing a very dangerous line.
The argument is, of course, needs must.
Yes, but with needs must, then what wouldn't you justify? If you really have, say, the famous ticking bomb scenario, then why not bring out the thumbscrews? They'd be even quicker, or the blowtorch. That would work. You're in a hurry, after all. What won't you do? The question is, does that argument ever work? And the answer, well, I think, is twofold. One is, we've never actually had a case of a ticking bomb where you know you've got the right person and you know he knows everything you want him to know. And contrariwise, so to say, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the most celebrated victim of this process, in American hands at any rate, is said to have given up a lot of junk information in response to being waterboarded, because people will, I can now see why, say anything.
In a word, what should happen with the practice?
It should be discontinued.
Christopher Hitchens.
Right. Well, that was very interesting, and I should point out that Christopher Hitchens was actually a strong advocate of the war on terror. He died a few years ago, but during that early phase, he was very strongly supportive of a lot of the things that America was doing in relation to the threat of Islamic terrorism. But he certainly his principles came to the fore on this particular issue. And, you know, I have to say, it's still very disturbing to me that Donald Trump, who has access to all this information, right, it's all out there in the public domain, as well as all the confidential information that he will have, that he could stand up publicly and say that he thinks torture is okay. And, you know, he actually wants to do it, but he's not going to do it because he's been overruled by his general. You know, that really still I find very, very disquieting. When we come back from the break, I want to talk more about some of the inner details of this. Stay with us with Truth News Radio.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do?
Welcome back, you're Truth News Radio. Talking about the moral and philosophical problems around torture in the wake of the recent statements by Donald Trump. And of course it is very comforting that he is now backed down from actually advancing torture and saying that, you know, the US is going to get back into torturing people. But he still says that he thinks it's a good idea. And this to me is something we really need to keep our eye on. It's really unfortunate that the media spends so much time focusing on the trivial or the ideological aspects of Trump that are really, to me, most unimportant. You know, whether he's sexist or not, or whether he said nasty things about women. I mean, these are so trivial, yet the media makes this the main focus of everything they talk about and actually neglects the really important criticism and paying attention to, putting the spotlight on some of the problematic, truly problematic aspects of what Donald Trump has advocated. And torture is really the top of the list for me. And it's one of these things that you can't underestimate its importance. And it's also a subject that many people do have a misguided idea about. I know a lot of people are aware, a lot of people are educated, probably everyone listening to my show already knows this, but believe me, there are a lot of people out there in the community who don't and who have been influenced by kind of romanticized Hollywood ideas about torture. And I remember back, 8 to 10 years ago when this was a big subject because of what was going on in the CIA black sites that had leaked out, some of my colleagues at work would say, oh, you know, you've got to torture people. Everyone does it. You know, it's part of how we operate. And this is kind of this mentality that people think it's okay because they've seen it on TV. It's been now kind of given a stamp of approval by leaders. And these people aren't educated. They don't understand the history. They don't know about the history going back to the Second World War, when torture was actually regarded as a serious war crime and people could be hanged for it. It was something that the Japanese did, particularly waterboarding. And it was something that that we created the Nuremberg war crimes trials to try and deal with. But what happens with this layering of propaganda build up over time with people who are not properly educated is that they just have a very, very thin, superficial concept of what this is all about. One thing that's very important to understand, one very important distinction to understand in torture, because there are different types of torture and it is done with different motivations, but the deeper, the darker, the more disturbing motivations tend to be the ones which always surface over time. And as an institutionalized practice of torture becomes the norm, the psychopathic elements, the predatory elements of human nature start to rise to the surface when you create prison scenarios where people are given the freedom and the tools and told, you know, you can just go ahead and basically do whatever you want to this individual. It releases something very, very dark in people. Now, let me just also focus on this distinction between torture for the purpose of getting real information versus torture for the purpose of getting predetermined statements, i.e. confessions. Again, these two objectives blur into each other. And when we have a program of torture, it may start out at the beginning with the aim being to get true, valid, verifiable information. I mean, that normally is a logical thing that people want to do with a practical goal that they're trying to attain. But, and this is partly due to the incredibly ineffective nature of torture, this sort of information is not regularly gleaned because torture doesn't work very well at getting real, verifiable information. We then get the secondary purpose of torture, which is to validate scenarios through confessions, which those who operate the torture facilities want to have, often in written form, so that they can say, well, yes, this proves that, you know, all these people were our enemies and they were conspiring against us. And look, we have all these confessions, and it's just as well we locked them up and tortured them because, look, they were actually treasonous, and they were going to do terrible things. They were going to do worse things than we did to them. So we're only defending ourselves by torturing them. This is the type of rationale. And one of the best examples to look at where this leads, the worst case scenario, and it's always good to see that, is Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, because the Cambodian regime started off as being an idealistic implementation of Marxism, and it had a lot of connections with other communist groups, and many people around the world thought in the beginning, oh well, the Khmer Rouge is there and they're liberating the people, and even the Cambodians themselves believed that because Cambodia had been oppressed by a colonial regime and had not had the sort of freedom that the rest of the world takes for granted, and they thought that the Khmer Rouge were going to bring that about. But what Pol Pot became obsessed with, and this is mirrored by Stalin and Mao and other leaders of that ilk from the 20th century, what they became most concerned with was enemies of the revolution and rooting out those enemies and arresting people purely on suspicion with no evidence, and then torturing them to try and get that evidence that they wanted became the standard practice. Now, I've just got another video clip here that I'm going to play to you that describes a little bit of that took place in the primary torture centre that the Khmer Rouge used in Phnom Penh. It was known as S21. And here we go. This is from a little documentary on it, an expert here talking about it. Here we go.
So S21 existed to reveal those external enemies. All the people who went in confessed after being tortured the most ridiculous crimes, that they were enemies of the regime and that they somehow interfered with the policy or with their ideology. People were brought in S21 blindfolded and tied to each other by their necks. Then an administration process began. Photographs were taken, people had to give their autobiographies, people were tossed prison clothes, men were separated from women and children, and then they were led in further into the prison. Nobody could escape torture. Their nails were pulled out, they were beaten, they were electrocuted or subject to waterboarding. They even had to pay homage to dogs with the head of Ho Chi Minh or President Johnson. Well, there were also many, many other different torture methods, the one more cruel than the other. People had to confess to all kinds of crime, even if they hadn't done anything. They also had to name many different names of other so-called traitors. This all proved there were many enemies and thereby justifying the repressive regime.
Throughout time, thousands of people worked in S21 under the leadership of Doig. Who were they, and how could they commit such inconceivable crimes?
Psychological research showed that Doig was pretty much stable, another raging madman. It's also too easy to put the whole staff away as crazy. Therefore, it's really important to look at the system in S21, the system in which this all took place. One can give many explanations to the cruelty that happened. Did they dehumanize the victims, or did they simply get used to their jobs? They could also have the feeling that they were just a small cog in a machine without seeing the overall picture and ignoring the results. It could also be indoctrination. There are also many other explanations we could give, but I don't think those were the most important explanations. The most important explanation I found for the functioning of S21 was the widespread fear and the great loneliness of the staff members. They were strictly monitored and strictly separated. They were separated in different units. They could often not walk freely over the compound and sometimes even could not talk with each other. Many staff members feared for their lives because only the slightest mistake or suspicion could lead to imprisonment at their former working place. On average, at least one staff member a week was killed in S21. So they had good reasons to be scared, and they had to face the authority in complete loneliness. And many staff members saw obedience as their only option. And this itself is an interesting outcome because many theories in the field of genocide studies give conformity theories as an explanation for the crimes they commit. It means that people feel a kind of peer pressure to a group and therefore commit their crimes. But in S21, everything was done to avoid group forming. Everything was done to distract group forming so that people were completely lonely.
In S21, just as in the entire country, all the social ties were cut. The lives of many perpetrators depended exclusively on the notion of the authority.
I just have to leave it there. We're just almost at the end of the show. Some key points to note from that is the kind of spiral effect that when you unleash these forces is hard to know where it will end. And Abu Ghraib is another great example of that. I mean, what actually ended up happening in Abu Ghraib was not planned in advance, but the prison scenario was created and then a carte blanche was given to individuals, and then the peer group pressure all created a spiraling effect. And this happens in every scenario where you start to legitimize things that are anathema to human civilization and the sanctity of human life. We're at the end of the show. I hope that's been interesting, and I hope you think about it in relation to everything we're going to hear about this in the coming months.